Brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, special operations military news, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
And hello again, everyone. Welcome back to Soft Web Radio, Soft Web Radio on time, on target. We have a great podcast lined up for you folks this afternoon. We're talking with another politician who's running for state rep. A couple of months ago, we spoke with a gentleman, a retired Marine Corps colonel who was running for office in Kentucky. And now we're going to talk to another lieutenant colonel, Ingrid Centurion, who's running for state rep in the state of Massachusetts. We want to welcome her to the podcast. Mrs. Centurion, welcome to Soft Rep Radio.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. And I know that reading some of your bio, you're an Iraq War veteran, and as well as being a small business owner, but you are a pilot. And share with our listeners a little bit about your military career.
Yeah, sure. Well, I started flying when I was 16 and became a private pilot at 17. And so I share that story with everybody because I knew what I wanted to be at a young age. And I saved all my money and $3,000. And my mom drove me out to the airport and I became a private pilot 4 months later. And then I decided, okay, I love this. I want to be a commercial pilot. And by the time I was 21, I had my commercial license. I was actually a CFI, II, multi-engine instrument instructor. So my dream at that time was to go fly for the airlines. I want to be that airline pilot, Delta pilot. But I got an Army ROTC scholarship. So after college, I had to go into the military and serve. And I got active duty, and I was in flight school down at Fort Rucker. Females back then, you know, we got the Huey transition, and then after that we would go to maintenance test pilot school. Most of the girls were logistics or maintenance, so I became a maintenance test pilot, and my first assignment was in Korea. And back then we flew single pilot. I remember flying all by myself along the Korean border, and I share that because today young kids at 17, 18, they all need to take on more responsibility and really grow and mature. And we need to put more responsibility in our kids and get them working as young as possible so they understand and have a strong work ethic. So then I went in after that, I went into, you know, I was on active duty. From there, I went to Korea, came back. As far as my whole 20 years, I was stationed at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. I flew VIP there. We had Hueys and Blackhawks in that unit. I was there for a long time. And then from there, I was sent to Fort Rucker. So down at Fort Rucker, I was had a company command there. My second one, I had one at Belvoir. And then I was in charge, being a maintenance officer, I was in charge at one time of all the helicopters down at Fort Rucker, 527 of them, all the different platforms. And every time an aircraft went down, safety of flight would come out. My job was to develop the get well plan, because the Chinooks went down for parts, the Black Hawk went down for some safety of flight, the Apache went down. I mean, it was a very stressful job down there. And down at Fort Rucker, normally we have a contractor. Back then it was DynCorp, and DynCorp, you know, was responsible for providing the maintenance services for our fleet. But that was really great. And then, do you want me to go over the whole career?
Maybe we'll you can talk about whatever you want. This is your time, you know?
Yeah. So anyway, I love flying. You know, I did start flying early, and I really was kind of like a little bit of a stick pig. I went from one flying job to another flying job to another flying job. So I was able to build my flight hours. Then I got transitioned into a Black Hawk while I was at Fort Rucker. Mm-hmm. And I went to the instructor pilot course at Fort Rucker. And actually, yeah, let me move to the second company command that I had, which was being the first female commander of the all-male Hispanic flight training unit down at Fort Rucker, called, at that time, it was the Helicopter School Battalion, formerly known as the School of the Americas.
Okay.
And so all the guys, whether they were GS or warrant officers, they were all instructor pilots, and many of them were of Hispanic and Latino descent. Some of them were American who knew how to speak Spanish, so that was great. So being the first female company commander there, that was a great experience because most of the Latino community, you know, they're not used to having female as their boss. And so I was the first one, and it was great. I had a great experience, and they taught me a lot. You know, I learned to become an instructor pilot with, you know, the old guys who flew in Vietnam and these pilots that have, you know, 5,000, 6,000 hours. So that was a great experience. And I love teaching and I love training. And that's actually kind of like what I'm doing now. So, but then after that, I was offered a fixed wing transition. And this career that I had is very strange. Like most people, most pilots that you meet in the Army or most retired lieutenant colonels, they normally don't fly three different aircraft. So that's why I say I'm, you know, was a little bit of a stick pig. And then then they offered me the fixed wing transition when I was a major. So I took that and I got my top secret clearance. And then I transitioned into the 15th MI battalion at Fort Hood. And from there, we deployed to Iraq.
And what year was that? What year were you in Iraq?
Oh, man, I always forget the years now.
Yeah, I know. Son. I know that feeling real well.
Right.
Was it the second Gulf War when we went in 2003?
I flew, and I deployed over there under originally it was the 504th. MI Brigade out of Fort Hood, and then we transitioned to the 500th MI Brigade out of Hawaii. And
oh, wow.
I was actually, when I first went to Fort Hood, I was in the S3 shop, and I helped that whole brigade deploy to Iraq. So that was a really great experience, very, very demanding for me, deploying all those units and transitioning them and getting, and, you know, the load plan and loading the equipment. And I just remember all the stress on the company commanders and all the majors as they were coming in, because it was, you know, long days mm-hmm. deploying a whole unit.
Right. And we were so dependent on our aircraft over there. I mean, it had to have been a very busy time at that point.
Yes, it was very busy.
So, and you have a military family. I read in your bio that you've been married for over 20 years to your husband, who's a retired infantryman, and your youngest son is in the Army now at Fort Benning?
Yes, yeah, exactly, yeah, yeah. So my husband's retired Army infantry. He was in the old guard, and that's where we met. And my son, who was 19, just graduated from high school, wanted to go to college in Arizona. He goes out there and he joins the Army. The recruiter apparently signed him up. He's in infantry training. I think he's graduating next week. We can't go to the graduation. And
right.
Then he will go back to Arizona. He joined the Arizona National Guard, and the Army will pay for his, you know, college. So that's good. So he's saving us some money there.
Yeah.
And he's studying. He's really following in my footsteps exactly. He's going to be getting a degree in aerospace engineering. He's going to join Army ROTC at ASU. And then when he graduates, he wants to be an officer and go on active duty. So we'll see.
Excellent.
What happens. Yes.
Well, Well, good luck to him, and we wish him all the best on that. Yeah. And I saw as well that you're an advisor to the Veterans Entrepreneurial Training and Resource Network. Can you fill us, our listeners, in on what that's all about?
Yes. So, you know, I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur. You know, I love the Army, but I always wanted to, you know, when I retire, you know, I had plans to wanted to be a consultant, right? All those high paid consultants that you see, you know, I'll say, you know, all those old guys that are, you see them and they're still working and you're like, you know, why aren't they playing with their grandkids? Right. But, you know, I get it now. You know, they want to stay relevant. They want to stay current. They love reading and learning. I think that's what it all comes down to. And you got to keep your brain active and your body, right? So when I moved up here when I retired. Oh, let me talk about that. So my last assignment, without going through, you know, every assignment, my last assignment was working along the border at Joint Task Force North in El Paso. Mm-hmm. And there, I was a mission planner, and I would plan missions in coordination with the Border Patrol to help surveil the border. And I flew an aircraft that I packaged with cameras and sensors on them to look for the illegals coming across the border, as well as the drug trafficking and the narcotics that come across the border. And it was really interesting to see what comes across that border every single night. And I caught, you know, hundreds of pounds of marijuana with the Border Patrol. And it's amazing how open the border is. You know, I know that there's some border wall, but the border is so long, right? And we're talking about the ground side. Then you have the maritime side. And then you have the air. So at the time, we had, this was like almost 10 years ago now, we had ultralight aircraft flying across the border, dropping 400 pounds of marijuana. And I wanted to figure out how can we stop this from occurring. So I reached out to a company here in Massachusetts, a really high-tech technology company, and I met with them and I asked them, hey, give me some ways and some capabilities of how would you take down an ultralight? And they gave us a briefing and they shared some awesome ways we could do that. And that's how I met this company called Kinetic North America. And that's with a Q. Q-I-N-E-T-I-Q, Kinetic North America. Oh, wow. And when those guys came out to El Paso to give us a briefing, I'll always remember it because they were so motivated and they had all this cool technology. And they were all special operations guys, now that I look back at it. Not all of them, but about four on the team. I remember there was one guy that was a retired lieutenant colonel. I don't remember his name now. But they came out and I said, wow, when I retire, I want to work for a company like that. I want to be part of a team that is continuing to support the warfighter. And that's a culture that I would easily adapt into. And so when I retired, I actually sent them my resume and they hired me to be the product manager of the tactical robotic controller. Now that was really cool. It was called the Universal Tactical Robotic Controller. And this was a small handheld controller that was designed for the Marine Corps Warfighting Lab. And the Marines had developed this lightweight universal controller that would fly Class 1 UAVs, drive ground robots, monitor unattended ground sensors, and even and drive unmanned maritime systems. So I love technology, and I was like, oh my gosh, I got to have this job. And that's what I did. I was helping get the Universal Tactical Robotic Controller into the Marines, into the Navy, into all the different services.
I saw that on your website. There's a picture. I take it it's down on the border somewhere outside of El Paso with some, it looked like Marines and Army.
Yeah. That photo actually was at Camp Pendleton.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because our ground robots at Kinetic, we had the Talon. Are you familiar mm-hmm. with it? Yeah, yeah, we had the Talon, we had the Dragon Runner, and the combat engineers, you know, used those for IED clearing and keeping the soldiers and a warfighter out of harm's way. And that's what, you know, I tell people as a pilot in Army aviation, my job is always to support the men and women on the ground with whether it was airlift or it was bringing them logistics or it was providing them aerial reconnaissance and SIGINT. That's what we do. We support the guys and girls on the ground, guys and gals, and we want to keep them out of harm's way. Support.
Excellent. So you moved up to Massachusetts, obviously.
I moved up here. I had never lived here ever in my life, mm-hmm. but I always wanted to come back east because, you know, in the Army, you're assigned in Alabama, you're assigned right. in Texas, you're assigned in Virginia. You know, you pick up their accent, and you're not in New England. So I always wanted to get back to the East Coast because I'm originally from New Jersey.
Okay, well, you don't sound like you have a Mass accent yet, but
no,
there's
no,
still
no.
time.
Right, right. Actually, most people say you have kind of like a twang.
Yeah, like, yeah. You almost sound Virginia. So,
oh, Virginia. Oh, okay. I don't know what I sound like, but I think when I get upset or angry, my New Jersey attitude and accent comes back real quick.
That's it. You know, it always comes back to that, doesn't it? I mean, when people either get mad or they're counting to themselves, they go back to whatever accent they grew up with.
Right.
I've noticed
right.
that. So. I grew up in Mass and then went
Where?
Into the military. But you can take the boy out of Massachusetts, but unfortunately, you can't take the Massachusetts out of the boy. My accent, everyone always asks me, oh, do you still live in Boston? Yeah, okay. So,
where did you grow up here?
I grew up in Woburn. Right outside.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, and yeah. when did you leave?
I left in late 1979. I joined the military.
Oh, and, wow. You left a long time ago. And you've never
yeah.
been back?
Yeah. And then after I retired, I lived down south for a while. And then I did the Army contracting thing for a while because it was paying so well. And, you know, it wasn't until about 2000 my family moved back up there. And we lived right outside of Worcester, Massachusetts. And, we lived there for quite a few years, and now that my son went to college, and we love the South, and we moved back down south, and we're living in Florida now. So,
wow. Well, yeah. Another reason why I wanted to move to Massachusetts is I wanted my boys to shovel snow. I also wanted them to rake leaves because that's how I grew up. When you yep. have a strong work ethic, I think that's a good thing.
It's
you know,
a great thing.
You grow up in flip flops and. You know, we're out in the desert. There's not much cleaning to do out there. I think it's just a different way of life, different culture.
Well, there's plenty of snow to shovel up there. So
that's right. That's right.
Although
that's why my youngest son is like, I'm out of here. Yeah. He's like, I hate the snow.
Yeah. Well, this winter wasn't so bad. We only had a couple of storms, and
right.
But I mean, that's not a normal winter, but. So, yeah, you moved up. You worked as an entrepreneur. What made you decide to get into politics?
Oh, let me finish telling you that story.
Okay.
You know, so I got laid off at Kinetic because of sequestration and the military cutback and the spending. You know, it was just like a lot of people lost their jobs under Obama. And I was out of work. And I'm here in Massachusetts now. And so then that's when I started my own business. And I started helping other business owners grow their business. I was helping small companies get contracts with the Army. And, you know, it's so hard having your own business. You one, have to start a whole new network. Remember, I moved to Massachusetts. I don't have any connections here. I've never been here in my life. And And it's really hard for small business owners. So I got a letter from Lee Goldberg, who's the founder of Veteran, the Veteran Entrepreneurial Training and Resource Network. And it said, hey, you can go to this 13-week program. We'll help you grow your business. We met, and I went through that program. I was actually the first female to go through the program. And it was great. I met Lee, and I learned a lot. And then I changed my business model after that, and I started to do speaking and training. And now that's what I do. Well, it's hard now with the pandemic, but I was getting paid to speak as a motivational speaker. And I'm working on a book right now that's going to come out. And then as a speaker, one, you need to have a book, and then you need to have a program, training program. So I started to do team building sessions and soft skills training, communication training, and just teaching corporations how to build a really strong team and work together. Mm-hmm. And I like that as a trainer. You know, I was an instructor pilot, did a lot of that also throughout my career. And I realized that I do really love training and coaching and pushing people to their maximum.
Sounds like you could have had a career in special ops.
I could have, but they didn't let women in that field when I started. And then you get married and you have children, and it's tough to go into special ops when you're away from your family so much.
That part of special ops was very tough on the families, because back then, I mean, back when I was in, I mean, you were basically, you were a stranger in the home, you know, because you were
That's
gone
right.
all the time. They've since tried, well, now they tried to rein that in. And then with the war, the way it's been going, our guys have been tasked out, and they're actually overtasked these days. But that's an issue for another time.
Yeah, so, that is. And throughout this whole time, I've been taking care of my mother, and I've kind of always like kept that quiet, but taking care of a parent is a lot of stress as well. And
sure,
that's another reason why, you know, sometimes your career may not allow you to do certain things, because you don't have that freedom. You have responsibilities, and she's really been my responsibility, even though I have, you know, three other brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she I'm lives with you up in Mass?
Yes. She's with me up here in Mass. And I'm the youngest, and my oldest sister, we rotate her, and so we take care of her.
That's awesome. Yeah, we're our family, we're going through something similar to that down here as well. So I totally get where you're coming from there. And you also have your own local cable access television show. Is that dealing with, the same kind of, issues you were just talking about?
Well, this is how that happened. I started speaking, and I said, well, if I'm going to be a speaker, I need to be better on camera. I need to focus on when you see the people on TV, it's like, do they have classes for that? How do they do that? You know, I'm a pilot. I have never had any classes in speaking or communications or pronunciation or the tone of your voice. And these are all the things that I learned at the TV studio. And so I'm the producer. I lay out the story. And really, being a great speaker is just storytelling and sharing and connecting with your audience. And most people that strive to be a speaker, they may not realize that initially. And if you're not connecting with your audience, then you're not that good of a speaker. And that's what I needed to do. And so through having this TV show, which I like, you know, motivating people, it's called Inspiring Careers. And I learned how to angle the camera. I learned how to do lighting. I learned how to edit. And it's really about building that story. So that has really helped me, actually, now that I'm going into politics, because in politics, you have to speak to people, you have to have presence, and people need to trust you. And if they can see me on camera, that will really help. And I've been able to do that. I'm sharing my issues, what I believe in. on video, and that's been really great during my race.
So, yeah, speaking of which, you know, you decided to throw your hat in the ring for state rep. And what made you decide that? Was it just because of the situation that's out there, or do you just see a need to serve?
Well, I always say I am not a professional politician. And you said I have this politician on the line. No, I'm a mother first. I'm a veteran. I'm a small business owner. I'm a caregiver. I'm all those other things. And I'm a soldier. I choose now to serve because it's needed. And I am in a very Democratic state. And I'm
Republican. Yes, you are.
That's right. And this is your state. This is your state. And so I need you to help me take back Massachusetts. And what I've been observing here, because I've never, you know, really been involved in legislation, is I have a lot of friends that go to the representatives here and they ask for help on a certain issue and they're ignored. So I think that, you know, here in Massachusetts, Beacon Hill, they're not listening to the people. They're not listening to the small business owners. And that's the most important thing a legislator should do, is listen to the people and help them resolve their issues, come up with a solution. And I want to bring responsive leadership to Beacon Hill. And if I win, people need to know that that's what representatives do. They don't push a certain ideology on people. They need to listen to all the people, whether they're Democrat, Republican, or independent. We're all Americans first. And it just bothers me that people stereotype and label me just because of a political party. I'm running because I want to bring people together, not divide us. And it's been really interesting. That's been the main reason of why I want to run, because I've always been a very productive, efficient, solution person, develop solutions, solve problems. That's the kind of representation that they need here. And I want to help small business owners, number one.
And that is so refreshing to hear, because I think that's something that not just Beacon Hill, but I think that's a symptom that we're seeing everywhere in this country. I mean, I think that a lot of people forget that their first duty is to represent all the people that they're serving. And we get too wrapped up in party politics today. And it's, no one's crossing the line. I think there's a lot of issues out there, and I'm sure you'll tell us about some of those, that it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on. It's about serving the people. And I think that's, you know, it's like I said, it's refreshing to hear that, because we don't hear enough of it today.
No. And our founding fathers said political parties, it would be the destruction to good governance. We shouldn't be picking sides. We need to be working together. And you know, in the military, that's what we do. We don't look at the color of your skin, your religion. We all come together and, you know, we're all green and we work together. And that's what I'd like to bring to the State House, if that's possible. But also, here in Massachusetts, you also need to realize that there is no balance. When you have 126 Democrats and 31 Republicans, is that balance?
No, it's not balance.
Right.
I didn't think there was that many Republicans. I know that Paul Frost was my state rep, but he was one of the few.
They really need to listen to their people. They need to get out there, and they shouldn't be professional politicians. You know, it's a 2-year term, and there should be term limits, and, you know, they need to be moving on and moving out and doing bigger and better things, or, you know, allow someone else an opportunity to serve their community and serve their district, because that's what they should be doing.
And I'm also
not happy with some of the current legislation that's being passed during a serious pandemic. that was another reason that caused me to run, because I have been telling everyone, listen, when there's an emergency, when serious things going on, leaders act. And mm-hmm. that's what we are in the military. We're leaders. We're all trained to work together as a team and lead. And so I'm not going to sit back and watch Massachusetts fall apart. So that's why I'm running, because I really believe in legislation that should be passed to protect the elderly, to protect our children. And safety and security is so important to me. Currently, in a pandemic, they're pushing legislation that doesn't even focus on, you know, on the real street problems that are going on.
Well, tell us some about the issues. I've checked out your website, so obviously I know what some of the issues that are near and dear to you. But you know, fill in our listeners about some of the issues.
Right.
That...
Well, I think the number one issue and that people are really concerned about is they're worried about their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They're worried about earning an income. Small business owners have not had a choice. So when all this happened, why was Walmart allowed to stay open, but mom and pop shops had to close? And they weren't even allowed to be open. That's not fair. And they weren't even given an option. When you know small business is the heart of America. And that's why I help small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that's the biggest problem. And if we don't have small businesses giving people jobs, what do these people do? They can't rely on the government, you know, to give them a check that's even sustainable. And for the rent, you know, rent is really expensive here. Food is expensive.
Yes.
And in some of these places in Massachusetts, there is no transportation. So you have to have a car. And having mm-hmm. a car is expensive and insurance is expensive. So this is what I'm saying right here. That is the real challenge for hardworking Americans, probably all around the country. But if you're wealthy and you're retired or these things don't concern you, these things don't get fixed.
And what's the current feeling around Massachusetts? Are things getting anything close to back to normal yet or no?
Well, I think every town is different. Mm-hmm. In a lot of people, depending upon what community and town you live in, some people are really, really scared of COVID. You know, they've been inside for 3 months, 4 months. They're all working from home. And I know as a caregiver, the adult daycare place that my mom would go to, it's still closed. And that's really sad because there were so many people that went to this adult daycare. And at the daycare, they do activities, they interact, they keep their brain functioning. You know, they get up every day, they take a shower, they go to the location and the facility, and all of that's closed. So I could see all these individuals at home getting depressed. You know, who's taking care of them? And I think that's a big problem. You know, the
sure,
depression,
and that's...
I think.
That isolation from their peers is got to affect them as well. I mean, because that's something, you know, in my town where I lived in Millbury, I mean, the senior center was really, really busy all day long, every day of the week. And, you know, that was an area where they would go. And like you said, they'd get involved in activities. They'd stay active. You know, and right now I know a lot of people there are hurting because of it. And it's not just worrying about the COVID. It's their mental outlook on things as well. And that's something, you know, I believe in protecting our seniors and veterans. And I know, obviously, that's something that's near and dear to you as well.
Right. The other thing is, you know, being in the military, that physical fitness is essential to us. Being in mm-hmm. shape, exercising, to exercise our bodies. And when all this happened, the gyms are all closed. And even to this day, I think some of the gyms are closed. They may never open again. Owning a gym anyway, they've always, I think, always struggled. And so the gyms were closed. And you know, these gyms, they could have in place the proper safety protocol, cleanliness, all those kinds of things to stay running without having to shut them down for 5 months. And I think that's another area where, you know, exercise is essential for some people because that keeps them mentally sane and physically healthy, as well as, let's say you go into rehab, you need your physical therapy, and if you can't go to the gym and do that kind of stuff, your body deteriorates, your mind deteriorates, and this all goes back into, you know, how do you deal with a pandemic and, you know, all this that happened. You have to place your small businesses at the forefront so they don't lose everything that they've worked for.
Absolutely. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, your feelings on education as well, because I did read some of your stuff on your website, and I think that's something that our listeners would like to know about.
I'm a multicultural person, and the children always come first. The way I grew up, the children would eat first. Our children come first. We're responsible for the safety and the education of our children. And I think when you look at this whole pandemic, there also should have been a priority in, okay, how are we going to get these kids back into school? How are we going to continue to teach them? And I know everybody's worked through it and they're doing online stuff, but kids can't be cooped up in a home. I've knocked on doors and gone into real small homes, and when those kids come to the door, they're excited to see me. I don't think they've seen anybody in months. And you know, kids need to get out, they need to play, they need to release all that energy. And I think it's been really hard on working moms or single moms or mom and dads who both work, and now one of them has to stay home and figure out how they're going to be the teacher and still work at the same time. So education is so important on, okay, how are we going to move forward with these kids? When are they going to open back the schools and come up with the safety procedures and the cleanliness and cleaning your hands and whatever the social distancing or take their temperatures? I think we can be a little bit more proactive when it comes to getting the kids back into school. Because right here in Massachusetts, somebody was telling me that his kids, they play lacrosse, and they finally let them practice, but they have to stay 6 feet away from each other. That lacrosse is a like a contact sport.
Yes, it is. It's especially for the boys lacrosse team. I mean, that's a very much a contact sport, and you know, it's very physical one at that. So I don't know how you would practice keeping 6 feet distance. I mean, I don't
Outside,
know.
this is what a parent told me actually today too. And then he said, well, inside, if they're going to go back to school, they're going to do anything inside. Inside, they could be 3 feet apart. And I was like, does that make any sense? Because inside, you know, if the germ or bacteria is in the air, you're more likely to get it. Outside, you're not as likely, and you're in the sun and things like that. So everyone is just very confused right now. What do we do? And I think the biggest thing is you stay in good shape, you know, you lower your blood pressure. If you have diabetes, you work on losing that weight, you do all those things. You do all these things to try to be in the best physical shape as possible. And that is what's going to help you defeat the virus if you get the virus. Because if you do get the virus, hopefully you survive.
Right. And you know, what's the situation look like up in the state? Are they going to allow the schools to open in the fall, or is it going to continue with the way they finished this last school year?
I heard some schools are opening in September, but most of the parents that I talked to are really not sure. I don't think they've been told all the details about that.
Yeah, I mean it's a tough decision. I mean, I know a lot of people feel, you know, depending on who you talk to. I mean, some people feel very differently, and I know some teachers are very nervous about, you know, teaching again in a crowded school, and I understand that. I mean, it's just something we're going to have to work through. But I don't know if there's an easy answer to any of it. That's why we're going to hire people like you to, you know, take over the leadership.
Well, I have all kinds of ideas and solutions on how to administer that, but it requires discipline and respect. And sometimes that can be hard for the teachers to instill in the students when they all get together. But, you know, if the kids follow the rules and if they have respect for each other and for their teacher, we can get them all back to school and learning again. And that's a good lesson. Our young kids do need to learn respect for the elderly, respect for their parents, respect for property, respect for their teachers, and respect for themselves.
Yeah, I firmly in agreement with you there. So how can people, how can they help out your,
yes,
you know, your campaign, and how
can they
get involved?
Help out my campaign. All those Massachusetts, Massachusetts-born people who've left this state, they can help me by going to my website at ingrid4rep.com, and they can donate to my campaign. They can connect with me on Twitter, all the social media. I have Instagram, I have Twitter, I have a YouTube channel. They can subscribe to my channel and like my post, share my post. And this is where it all started, right here in Massachusetts. And that's another thing that's so interesting. I never thought I'd be running for politics, but here I am.
There you are.
And I have been truly blessed by people coming and helping me who are veterans, you know, like Sal that
right.
introduced us. And he's awesome.
Sal's a great guy. Either. And yeah, in fact, Sal was the one that, you know, he had asked me if I had heard of you. And I said, no, I actually, you know, because your area was just east of where I lived. So
right.
I hadn't heard of your campaign. But when Sal told me about it, he was very much a supporter of you. You know, he sent me the info, and I immediately said, well, we're going to reach out to her. We're going to get her on the podcast, and hopefully we can, you know, drum up some positive feedback and get some, you know, momentum going for
your
election.
Yeah. So, you know, the biggest thing is, you know, the donations and the following on the social media. So people support me and we build a strong grassroots organization and let people know. I mean, this is where it all started. So we got to take it back. We can't allow, a small group of people with a certain ideology to think that, whatever they say is right. We all need to respect everybody and respect each other's opinions. And I was telling someone today, you know, I'm not going to push my religion on anyone. I respect everyone's different faith. I respect everyone's family, and that's what representatives and politicians should do, is, you know, do what's best for America and Americans.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people talk about, you know, immigration and immigrants, and your father and both of your parents came from Argentina, wasn't it?
No. My dad is from Argentina. My dad was a professional soccer player. So I didn't know my dad. My dad died when I was 2 years old. I was raised by a single mom. And my mom was born in Puerto Rico. And my mom came to New York when she was, I think, 5 years old. And she had seven brothers and sisters. And they moved to the Bronx, New York. And so my dad was playing soccer in New York. Back then, it was just the Cosmos and the 50s and stuff like that. Yeah. So he met my mom. She was working. She was a waitress. And they got married. They had four children. And my dad was from the country in Argentina, Santa Fe. And then they moved to Buenos Aires. And so my dad really didn't like New York City. And we lived in New Jersey. So that was like, you know, the country for New Yorkers. I mean, it's only like 20 minutes away across the George Washington Bridge, but all my cousins in New York were like, oh, you guys live in the boondocks. And my dad died, though, when he was 30 years old in a car accident. My mom was in the car, but my mom didn't die. You know, she was hurt badly. And that's one of the reasons why she has dementia today, because she had a lot of injury to her head. Mm. And I keep her very busy. I keep her very socially active. So she,
that's important,
you know, keeps that brain working. I make her do math problems. And that's what dementia is. Your brain is shrinking. You're forgetting. Your parts of your brain are shutting down. And you want to keep that active.
Well, that's great. And
so my dad was from Argentina. He came here legally. You know, so I'm first generation American, and actually my husband, he is also immigrant. So he is originally from Mexico, and his family as well came here, and he became an American citizen by going into the army. And yeah, so all my friends are immigrants from other countries who left those countries to escape communism, to escape and not just escape, just, you know, to have a better future. And they all came here legally. Some of them even were in refugee camps and then had the opportunity to come here. And I think that's the right way to do it, you know, to follow the laws, do it properly. And then if you're here, find a way to become an American citizen. And that's a good thing.
That's awesome.
You assimilate into the country, you learn the language, and then you work. But I think our whole immigration system as well needs to be corrected and fixed. And but we just can't have, you know, people crossing our borders illegally. We I like to say this is an identification problem. We need to know who's here and what their intentions are, just like your own home. You just don't let anybody come into your home, right? If you have a party, you're going to let strangers in? It's that simple.
Yeah.
And once we know who's here and, you know, if they have good intentions, then that's great. You get to stay. But we have people here who are threats to America. And I don't think that the average person may understand that. You know, you and I, we worked in the military. We had top secret clearance. We know that you know, national security is an issue. But if you've never lived in a border town, you've never lived in an area where you see that, you don't see, you know, you may think that that's not true or it doesn't happen.
Right. Well, you know, it's a complicated situation.
It
and again, it comes down. A lot of it comes down to politics, and you know, this is something where, as a country, we all need to get together, and you know, we have to agree on what's best for the entire country, and not for any particular, you know, political party. So,
right.
Hopefully, that's one of the things you can change, and it has to start somewhere, and no place better than where it all began in the state of Massachusetts. So. But Ingrid, we want to really thank you for your time, your patience, all of our questions, and, you know, for your insight. And we wish you the very best in the upcoming election. And hopefully we can do this again soon when we're talking about the newest state representative from the state of Massachusetts.
Wow, that would be so awesome. I love it. And I tell everyone, I will represent you well, and I would do everything I can, just like I've done my whole career, to help others and help families and help everyone.
Well, thank you very much, and all the best to you and to your family as well. And we'll be watching the polls, and hopefully we're going to hear some good news.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. We've been on the air, Software Up Radio, with Ingrid Centurion. She's running for office in the state of Massachusetts, a retired lieutenant colonel. And we want to thank her for being here on the podcast this afternoon, Software Up Radio, on time, on target. Please join us again for another upcoming episode. We'll be back real soon But for myself, Steve Balistrieri, all of us here at SoftRep, and for our guest this afternoon, Ingrid Centurion, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to SoftRep Radio.